Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Lauren Ray is a British singer, songwriter and producer with three albums under her belt. Her debut album, We Will Need Courage, was recorded in Nashville and released in 2016, which led to her touring alongside incredible artists such as Lucy Spraggan, Rebecca Ferguson and Paul Carrack. Her second album, Woman in the Arena, was released in 2020, receiving praise and a feature by The Telegraph, and being picked up for sync by numerous TV shows, including Love Island and the UEFA Champions League final. Her third album, Quarter Life Crisis, was released in 2024 and is her first foray into producing for herself. Lauren now lives in London, where she moved after completing a degree in anthropology. She has always been obsessed with the human psyche, and in 2020, she took the pandemic-forced time out from touring to become a certified mindset and high-performance coach. Now, alongside her songwriting and performance schedule, she works with clients all over the world, specializing in revealing the limiting beliefs and subconscious narrative that dictate and shape behavior and performance. Her ability to explore the human condition has had a huge influence in her creativity over the years. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Lauren Ray.
Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I am currently in London, UK, and I am doing good.
Let's rewind. At what age, whether as a child or teenager, did you think, cool, I want to be in the creative music, creative world? And how did that journey progress to where we are today?
I don't know at what age I had a conscious awareness of like wanting to be a singer, but I have been singing incessantly, much to the dismay of my family, since I could talk. Like, I'm a family of six, so mum, dad, four siblings, and every single family trip, we'd all be like rammed into a car and they would put me in the back with the luggage because I would sing the entire time. So that's like how, for context, how long I have been incessantly singing. I think it was probably when I was a teenager that I was kind of becoming more aware of like the possibility of like, there are artists, you know, there are singers. And then I think, to be honest, it wasn't really until, because I was born 87. So I grew up 90s baby, but also we lived in Austria and Poland. So the only music I was exposed to was baseline radio pop. So it was mostly the Spice Girls, you know, Britney Spears, all those kind of things. So I actually didn't think it was possible for someone like me who doesn't have the pop vibe in that traditional sense to be an artist. So I think it may be actually, now that you've asked me the question, I think it may have been where artists like Norah Jones and Casey Mellower and people like that came onto the kind of pop landscape because they were soft vocals sitting at a piano. And I was like, that's what I do. And they're making it. It's fine. So that's probably how it started, where I had like a sort of a seed was planted that the type of music that I write, the way that I like to sing and write was a possibility. And then I sort of did the typical thing where I sort of, you know, left school and I was like, I'm not going to go to university and college like everybody else. I'm going to try and become a singer-songwriter. And my parents and my sister moved to Poland in that time. So I was kind of like living above a cafe in the UK and working in a pub. And a year went by and I wasn't really achieving a whole lot. So I decided to go to university kind of partly to kill time, but also to have somewhere to live. I was like not wanting to live above the shop anymore. So I did a degree in anthropology and that kind of distracted me from my music for a bit. I was doing some open mic nights and stuff like that, but I was loving the degree. Fast forward, I was then living in London, trying to make it as a singer-songwriter, but really I was kind of in the old music industry. Like, I think I was kind of coming up into my 20s, sort of in that cusp where the old music industry was still very prominent. Like, it was before streaming, all that kind of thing didn't really exist yet. People were using social media, but not in the ways that they were now. And so a lot of my attempts at becoming a singer-songwriter were very 90s driven, which basically, for anybody who's not as old as I am, that basically means I went to a lot of open mic nights and I was waiting to be discovered. That was pretty much my entire attempt of creating a career. And then I hit my mid to late 20s and I thought, okay, this isn't this plan isn't working. Like, I'm now working in an office, working at a record label, which is great. But the idea that I was sold as a kid, which is you just sing in an open mic night, some A&I guy walks in, and then you're discovered, wasn't happening. So I walked into a bank on my lunch break, got a bank loan, and I thought, I'm just going to do this myself. I'm just going to figure out how to get my music out there because I don't want to die and have not released an album. So I self-funded my first album. I went to Nashville to write. I always wanted to go. I basically just funded all the dreams I wanted to create myself. And kind of speeding through it. So when I released my first album, which is called We Will Need Courage, I recorded it in Nashville with an incredible producer. That led, within 12 months of releasing that album, it sort of led to a whole bunch of opportunities. I signed to a very small label shortly after that because they heard the album. I then had all these touring opportunities. So suddenly everything opened up. I'm like, oh, okay, I can make this happen for myself. This is amazing. And so I spent the next maybe 5 years writing new songs, writing my second album, recording my second album, touring incessantly. It was the most incredible 5 years. Then the pandemic hit. And I kind of, everything stopped. I sort of pivoted and actually became a certified mindset coach. I'm trained in hypnotherapy and all these kind of things. But that basically took me again out of my music again for about 2 years. And then I put myself back into it. And I have just released my third album, which is called Quarter Life Crisis. So that's kind of the whistle stop tour of me from a child to this date. And a lot of it is about getting out of my own way, essentially.
So what do you mean by getting out of your own way? In what instances did you see yourself in your own way? And how long did it take you to realize that you were there? And was it the same steps each time to get yourself out of it?
Yes and no. So I don't think I realized I was in my own way until I was maybe 25. And I think it was in part I was in my own way, but I also think that I was very much so sold on the old music industry idea. Like growing up, it was the only narrative I heard. You know, again, this is the social media. So the only narrative I heard was you just perform, and if you're good enough, you'll be discovered and it will happen. Yeah. Not kind of for you. And I think really it was a combination of that narrative being so deeply ingrained into my like being, but also I stumbled across a Brené Brown video on YouTube, which was her Power of Vulnerability TED Talk. And if anybody listening has not listened to that, please go and YouTube it. But for me, when I came across that video, it really was like being punched in the face in a really loving way, because it made me realize I thought I was going for it, but I wasn't really going for it. Like, in, you know, if I can see the sort of before mark, before realizing I was in my own way, and after, I mean, before I was just doing open mic nights, waiting for somebody else to create my career. After realizing I was getting in my own way, I walked into a bank loan. I got self-funded this whole thing and it all took off. And I think for me, the biggest realization at that moment was realizing that I was actually really afraid of really saying and really going for it. And then maybe discovering that I wasn't as good as I thought I was, and it wasn't going to work out. And so I think there was a part of me that was self-protecting. Again, none of this is conscious. So it was not a conscious decision, but it was like subconsciously I was protecting myself from really, really going for it. Because what if I tell everybody that I want to be a singer-songwriter and it doesn't happen? How mortifying, how embarrassing, how shameful. And so I always kept myself below the level of really trying.
I also find sometimes, and I would like to find out from you if this is a perspective in your experience, in your journey. I often find that sometimes people self-sabotage themselves because the fear of success, because now I'm successful, now I'm in the spotlight, now everyone will be looking at me, now everyone will be looking up towards me for more or responses or entertainment or expectations. Was that an element of it as well?
I don't necessarily think it was at the time. I think, especially now I'm a mindset coach, now I work with a lot of artists, a lot of entrepreneurs, and I see this in everybody. I actually think it's multiple layers. And I think for many people, it's about you uncover one layer, you work through that, and then you find there's another layer beneath it. I think the biggest thing that really was a massive blocker for me at that time to get things moving was that fear of failing, the embarrassment of like not actually making it. I think as I've then gained traction, I realized that over time, I do realize that I do have an upper limit. For anybody who's familiar with the Gay Hendricks book, The Big Leap, he talks about these upper limits where we only allow ourselves a certain level of success, because beyond that, again, that's when we open ourselves up to what if we suddenly have all of the eyes on us. And people understandably have that fear because cancel culture is insane. You know, the amount of visibility you get as a successful artist will absolutely inevitably mean that you get a lot of hate and stuff like that. But it also means that your relationships possibly will change. Your dynamics with your family will possibly change. The amount of money or responsibility that you have will change. So I think for everybody, we have a version of fear of failure and a fear of success. Yeah. And how much we allow ourselves to maneuver past that is different. And then it's just becoming aware of that. And what the way that I talk about it, it's like this fine tuning of becoming aware of it and allowing yourself to sort of dial up how much you're allowing yourself to have and dialing down the stuff that's getting in the way of you.
But it's also, I think that the only way relationships with family or friends will change is labels. So for example, I spoke to another artist and she, a while back, and she signed her first record deal at the age of 16 or 17. She had a number one and she lost all her friends because now they put you in this box of this label of being successful. And they saw that, okay, well, she's now this, which means that she won't want anything to do with us. It's about stripping away those labels and just seeing the person. But it's also important for the person who's achieving that not to get stuck in the ego of labels as well.
Yeah. And I think it's also recognizing that at the end of the day, that's true of every single person in that dynamic. And it's also true that for some people, they won't allow themselves to create success because they don't want to be labeled and potentially lose those friends. But actually what that's doing is everyone's just staying stuck together. Was actually, if you allow yourself to rise and you don't, you know, label yourself and you allow yourself to be who you are in a new evolved state, yeah, you may, some of those people may move behind, but that's on them. That's not, it doesn't have to be on you. And that's on them. And I think what's nice is actually sometimes when you create success, yeah, you may lose some of the people along the way who aren't able to kind of process that and they end up projecting onto you. But I think also what it's nice is that you actually raise the bar and show what's possible for those around you. Yes. And if you give them time and you give them grace and you give them space and you just keep being you and showing up, you'll actually be surprised at how many people become more courageous and expand their realities because they suddenly realize you can do it. It's like the person who ran the 4-minute mile, but the first, and I can't remember this person's name.
Yes.
The first person to ever run the 4-minute mile. Before that point, nobody thought you could run a 4-minute mile. But as soon as that person did, suddenly there was like, you know, 50 people doing it the next week.
Yeah.
That's the best example I can think of.
It's a whole thing of like, you know, that knowledge of the world society knowledge that if you can't see it or experience or know it, it means it's not possible. It actually is. Also not having... It's also knowing that it'll happen, but not having expectations of how it'll happen. So I've got a beautiful story around this. So Kylie Minogue is my favorite. Okay. I love me a Kylie.
Good taste.
So many years back in 2007, I came to London, not specifically to see Kylie, but she was having a tour at the same time I was there. And I booked two tickets to see a show. I put two tickets, one for the Wednesday night and Saturday night. I thought it's my favorite. It's my dream come true. I'm definitely buying two tickets. But I'd never been to London and I'd never seen the O2 Arena. So when I booked my tickets, I booked them as, you know, what I could see and understand of the diagram on the website. So I'm very much a comfortable person in the sense that I am comfortable to go to concerts by myself. The Wednesday evening, I was sort of up in the air, which was super cool because Kylie creates a character of a stage. So I got an eye view, but I saw there were a couple of empty seats here and there. So on the Saturday when I was going again, I thought, cool, I want to get there early and I don't mind giving money to exchange for an upgrade to a seat, empty seat down there. Now, the way I expected it to happen was that I'd go to the ticket lady, I'd exchange money and I'd get my upgrade. She said to me, no, they sold out. They don't do that in any case. Fine. I went to go have lunch somewhere and I was sitting there eating and a lady came up to me and said, oh, do you want to see the Kylie concert? So I'm like, I'm already going. So I finished my food and I started walking away and I heard my Reiki master instructor screaming in my head saying to me, it'll happen, but not the way you expect it to happen. So because I expected and saw it happening in that way, while it was happening in front of my eyes, I didn't recognize it. And then I did and I ran to her and I said to her, tell me. And she said, well, one of their friends couldn't be there. They're sick. It's £25 extra. I said, yeah. And I was a few rows up from the front. So the whole point of this whole story is just to give a description and visual for the visual people and words for the auditory people and feeling for the kinesthetic people to understand that, yes, always to just be, have an open mind that it will happen, but not necessarily the way you expect to happen. So that when it is happening in your front of your eyes, you can recognize it.
I love that. And I love the fact that that happened for you. So cool. A friend of mine invited me to the, I think it must have been the iTunes festival that they had in like London, where they had like different artists perform on different nights. Yeah. And at the time I was working at PPL, and one of my clients who works for a dance label invited me, and I was like, oh my God, free tickets to see Kylie. It was a great night.
In creating your music from 0 to 3 to 4 minutes of that song, what motivates, what invigorates that creative process? Is it easy every time? Do you collaborate with others? Let's unpack that journey.
So it has evolved over time. So for my first album, most of the songs, in fact, every single song on my first album, bar I think two, I had written on my own. I had really only just started to collaborate because like up until that point, I was kind of nervous about collaborating. And a lot of my songs from my first album were just songs I'd written mostly through my sort of late teens, early 20s. And most of those songs were written me at the piano, very much inspired by my own emotional stories, you know, my own relationships. A couple of them are inspired by like relationship dynamics I'd seen in movies. I just find the human psyche and the human dynamics so interesting. So I'm very drawn to like people's experiences. So I'm always sort of drawn by my own, but I often draw from other people, whether it's friends around me or whether it's a movie. But for the whole first album, it was written at the piano, and then I took it to the producer to kind of to pull it together. The second album was mostly collaborations, because that is when I was starting to like build my confidence with collaborating. It was me really putting myself out there and also allowing my creative process to evolve. I think what I had recognized in my first album that, you know, that was a real sort of segment of that was who I was at the time.
Yeah.
And the second album is a real perfect, like that's who I was. I was all mostly collaborating. I was wanting to write with a lot of female songwriters that I'd met as well. And again, it was very relationship driven, either my relationships or others around me. And that is what is inspired the second album. The third album is a little bit different. So the third album is the only album where it kind of was a bit bitty. So the first and second album were kind of really created in a bubble. It's like, this is the first album, this is the second album. Whereas the third album, partly due to the pandemic, partly due to the fact that I was traveling so much the last few years, I mean, I've been just spending so much time in different countries, that it meant that there are 5 tracks on the album, which are all collaborations. And then there's 5 tracks where completely written in isolation on my own when I was traveling, and for the first time I produced them for myself. And so those 5 on the album was the first scenario where I actually wrote whilst producing them. I didn't have any specific skill set in producing. It's just that I thought, you know what, let me give this a go. Opened up Logic on my laptop and thought, let me create outside of the piano. Like, let's see what I can create beyond the constraints of like how my brain typically thinks. So it really has evolved in that sense. And I actually really love the process of my third album producing for myself, because it did take me down creative alleyways that I wouldn't normally write about. It actually took me to different topics and different themes, because it took me out of the very specific boundary of how I create, how I'd been creating my whole life. Like ever since I was a teenager, it had always been me at the piano playing some kind of like crunchy, melodic, beautiful chords and then singing over that, which always led to be a relationship driven topic. Whereas the third album, I wrote a lot about a lot of different things. A lot of them aren't about relationships. Some of them are, but they're much more complex. I sing about inner child healing, which isn't obvious to others, but it's what it is about. I, you know, talk about the medicine of pain and all these kind of different things. And so it's really evolved over time, I think, which has been fun.
Moving into the production side of things, were there aspects of it that you were surprised were part of it? Or it was just like, okay, well, I'm just going to be open and let's step by step learn.
It's so funny because, you know, just pairing the kind of earlier conversation about getting in our own way, I had most of my life said the I am statement, I am not a producer. I had so definitively claimed that as a not, and I had always been raised and sort of told that I'm not technical. Like, my brother's a technical one, I'm the creative one. And so I had this very firm identity, like I'm not a producer and I'm not technical. And yet when I had this shift, and I won't go into the backstory of why that happened, but I just sort of had this brain switch where I was like, I'm just going to say I'm a producer now. This is what I'm going to do.
Yes.
And because I had the awareness of the old belief and I had the awareness of like me trying on this new belief, I just went into it very open. It's it was very trial and error. I wasn't really surprised. I was surprised at actually how much easier some aspects of it I found were. And I found that thinking about it's more of a curation was way easier for me rather than like thinking about it from a technical skill point. Because when I realized that, I realized I actually had been producing before. I wasn't pressing the buttons, but I was in the room with every single producer I've ever worked with. And I was saying, yes, I want that. No, I don't want that. This is what I'm going for. You know, I was part of the process. Obviously, yeah. They were leading and pressing the buttons. But when I started to think about it more like I'm just curating sounds, that freed me up a little bit. But I think I wasn't surprised that it was more of the technical aspects that threw me. One thing I definitely want to get better at and improve my skill set on before the next project starts is like vocal production and all of the sort of like nitty gritty parts of those things. But it's a very long-winded saying something surprised me, but also not really at all.
Okay.
That's a really boring answer.
No, it wasn't boring. You know, it gave me a massive aha moment about that whole aspect.
Perfect.
When you said, okay, I'm not this. The minute you change that belief, I think I just had like a whole bunch of, you know, the string of pills dropping.
Mm-hmm.
I had like a whole boom, 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 boom. So thank you. Was definitely not, I needed to hear that today. Thank you.
Perfect. Well, I hope anybody else listening also recognizes that like whatever comes after I am generally becomes true. So I just decided to change the I am. I was like, I am a producer. And I will say that actually the day that I decided like I'm just going to be able to call myself a producer, I changed on my Instagram bio. I just put the word producer in as a way of like really cementing it.
Yes.
Like, no one really cares. Like no one's noticed, but it was more for myself, like
yes,
really owning that title.
Yeah.
And then I think though the next 3 days after I claimed that, I produced a track called Los Angeles, which is on my third album. And that was the first track I ever produced. And bless her heart, she did her best.
I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs every month. For me, it's an energy exchange to you guys for all the hard work that you've done. I love the journey of the choice, the unpacking, the booklet, listening to song from one to whatever number. Not sure, you may or may not be aware that physicals are a massive comeback. Vinyl, CDs, cassettes, even cassettes. Vinyls, last year in the UK, 5.9 million sales, the biggest since 1990. In the UK, again, there's a basket of products that they gauge exchanges on. Obviously, there needs to be enough exchanges on it for the product to be in this basket for some other tax purposes. And because of the upsurge of CDs, they are now back in that basket. And the research is showing it's the younger, it's the teenagers and the early 20s that are diving into this world. And we also have the streaming platforms that people consume music on. What are your observations of the landscape at the moment?
I mean, I love all the stats you just shared. And it's really interesting because actually one of my nieces who is, I'm going to get it wrong. She's like 11, I think. Please, she's not listening to this. I think she's like 11 right now. I have so many nieces and nephews, I lose track of how old they all are. But she's 11. But about a year ago, she really, really begged for a vinyl record player for Christmas. That's all she wanted. She really wanted a Taylor Swift vinyl. That's all she really wanted. And I was like fascinated by the fact that an 11-year-old was wanting a vinyl record player specifically. And I thought, what has come into the cultural like ether that an 11-year-old child knows what that is and thinks it's cool to have it? That's crazy to me. For me personally, I have always really valued the fact that even though a lot of the fans who buy and people who buy my CDs probably don't even have a CD player, they have bought the CD as a way of being more connected to the music and being more connected to me and also supporting me in that way. So for me, I've always sold a lot of CDs, which has kept my music career going. Very grateful for that. I haven't yet done vinyl, but I know I will do because I know it's a massive resurgence. But let me answer this in two different ways. Me as a musician, I love the fact that there are so many different ways people can consume music and to be interconnected with it. I love the fact that people are buying CDs and vinyl because obviously as a music creator, that is how we all pay our rent. That's how we continue to create music. As a consumer, I like both. And I'm sure as a consumer, they like both as well. Like I have a whole lot of vinyls in my living room. Like I absolutely love holding them and seeing them and putting them on and like the whole curation of it, like they're taking it out of the city. It's a whole process. It's like it's like a ritual, you know, it's the ritual of it that I love and it's the whole thing. But I also love the convenience of streaming. And I know that streaming is such a complicated topic for artists in the music industry, but I think that it has so many pros as well as the many cons that it has. And I think that if we can get to a place where artists are able to benefit from both worlds of the accessibility and the reach that streaming and that gives us, but also the money from the physical and all that kind of thing, then wonderful. Yeah. But I'm kind of witnessing the change and witnessing the vocal, like how vocal people are getting about this. And I'm actually on the Artist Council for the FAC in the UK, which is the Featured Artist Council. And they are huge advocates and doing a lot to advocate for artists' rights when it comes to streaming, when it comes to all of these things. And so I do see a different side of it, which I'm very grateful for. But I mean, how do you feel about it? I'm kind of curious.
So from, like I said, I love the CDs. I always buy the CDs. Mm-hmm. For me, the sound quality on the physical is like stadium compared to being on the digital. Like for me,
yes,
it's like listening to on digital is like flat. I would needed to get a new CD player because, like I said, I was living overseas. I came back and so I wanted to get a new CD player. When was it? Like a year ago or a year and a half ago. And everyone was like, oh, there's no ways you'll be able to get CD players. You can't buy them anymore, blah, blah, blah. In South Africa, there's a platform called Takealot, which is similar to Amazon, but different.
Yes.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, I want to go see if there's anything on there, hoping for one great option. And there were like 50 to 100 options of CD players. I had to narrow it down and narrow it down. So I got my player and I teach spinning classes. So I do my playlists on Spotify for the for that. As I prep that on the Bluetooth on the player, but I'll listen to the same song on the CD compared to on the Bluetooth or the streaming. And the streaming is like diluted. It's flat. It's like mm-hmm. tinny. And the sound that comes from a CD is so engulfing and enveloping you, like hugs you. That I love. Yeah. Music's become so sort of throwaway and like not acknowledged through the streaming. It's like, oh, it's like, I don't like this. Just like skip it and move along. And besides the fact that it's costs you guys money and time to create that. And another fascinating thing is that a lot of the audience who buy a CD or listen to streaming more than that, go to concerts every now and then, they don't know. I spoke to a group of different 10 people at one time and 8 people at another time. And I said to them, if an artist has had 100 million streams of a song, how much money do you think they got? The first group said 50 million. The second group said 1 million. And I said to them, actually, it's like 1,000. And they were shocked and horrified by mm-hmm. those stats. So I think there's a lot of education, interaction, and communication that still needs to happen around this conversation and topic.
I think generally speaking, like it's just the sort of perception of celebrities, musicians, yeah. and obviously like, I'm not putting myself in that category at all, but I'm just thinking about the general public. They're seeing musicians and artists. And for the general population, the way that I think about it is like they perceive you as either a busker trying to make it or you're Beyonce. And there's not a lot in between. Yeah. So a lot of the time when we're asking that questions, they are thinking about the Ed Sheerans, the Taylor Swift, the Beyonces and that kind of thing. And yes, they are making money, but a lot of it's not necessarily coming from streaming. Exactly. And so I think that their perception of very wealthy celebrities making a lot of money, buying their houses and having this lifestyle, that is filtering into their understanding of actually where money is coming from or their perception of what is making them money. And so exactly. for everybody else who isn't Beyonce and isn't a busker, but somewhere in between, it's a difficult conversation to have. Like I've had a lot of my fans ask me, you know, why am I doing like more tours? And I did a post recently, just as sort of moving slightly away from streaming, but to the more the cost of touring. It's like, I just put on a headline show in London and I basically said, this is what I have to pay for this show. Like I didn't go into the breakdown of people's fees and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, I just basically listed, these are all the things that I pay for in order to show. That is why I'm not currently doing 7 different shows, because in every single venue, I will be paying for all these things. And unless I am bringing in like 1,000 people into a show, it's not worth it. And I'm not at a level yet where I am bringing 1,000 people. It's just not worth it financially for me. And so I think it's helpful just to have these conversations more exactly. so in all aspects of the industry, I think.
Okay, so I love this game. I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 minutes, 5 years, 50 minutes, I know your answer will be different every time. I'm not saying favorite. I'm saying top of mind.
Okay.
Once we finish this conversation, if you had to push play to 5 songs by other artists or push play to 5 artists, if you can't think of specific songs, who would those artists be? And if you can think of songs, what would the songs be?
Okay, I would listen to, so after this conversation, I would go to Emily Nicholas. So Emily Nicholas is definitely one artist I would listen to. I absolutely love her. She's actually the venue that I just did my headline show in London. It was her that I saw in that venue, a beautiful venue called St. Pancras, Old Church. I saw her about 8 years ago. Incredible artist. If anybody doesn't know her, please go check her out. I think the song that I first discovered her on is called Grown Up, but she has so many amazing songs. So she's one artist I would go listen to. Then I'd go listen to Ray just because she's so good. I mean, everything Ray does is so good. And I just also, I'm so invested in her story. Like I remember when she was tweeting about the fact that she was, her label weren't letting her put music out. And I just remember being so outraged for the whole situation. So it's been so amazing seeing where she's got to now. So that's someone else I'd listen to. Then I would probably go, let's say, like old school in my brain. I'd go maybe to like Ray LaMontagne, someone I love listening to growing up a lot. And if I want to kind of go for some easy listening stuff. Who else is top of mind in my brain right now? Then I might go to... Oh, do you know what I absolutely love is, so Mauro is an amazing Portuguese singer. Really, really cool. I saw her live recently. It was her and three guitars. Very cool. But she's also done a bunch of collaborations recently with more kind of funky kind of sounds. So Mauro is another artist. And then because I was confusing her in my brain with Muna, I'll say Muna.
There we go.
Pop, fun, cool guys. I was like, wait, I have no idea what my brain's going to come up with. But those five just came to mind. So there we go.
And I know if I had to ask you literally again now, you'd have another five. That's why I love the game. Probably. So Lauren, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
I would love to say just, well, first of all, thank you for listening, but also, you know, share music, like share music. It doesn't have to be mine, but just keep sharing music because it really does a lot for artists like me, for artists that you love. If you love a song, share it with somebody. If you love an artist, tell someone about it. Like that is such a powerful thing you can do in the industry because there's so much that we like the algorithm doesn't do, but word of mouth and just sharing a song with someone is such a powerful thing. So that's the one thing I would say.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.